And the topic for tonight is Buddha nature, so we'll see if we have anything to say about it. The notes I handed out are basically paragraph by paragraph through the talk, but not through the question and answer. So when we get to the question and answer, people can find what they're interested in and bring it out. So if we go through what's in here, it gets a little bit confusing, I think. But it begins with a summary of talk one. And that summary is very brief. It says, experiencing the spark of intelligence or enlightenment within us. So the feelings of inadequacy, pain, and confusion are seen as neither good nor bad. The search for pleasure, material or spiritual, is no longer convincing, no longer that carries any weight with us. So we talked for a whole hour about that. Does anyone want to go over any issues there? Okay, so Trungpa Rinpoche then makes the point that the sense of dissatisfaction is really the discovery of the first noble truth, which has been called suffering, or sometimes just frustration, or unsatisfactoriness. It does not have to mean intense, overwhelming pain. And the Sanskrit word we have for it is dukkha. And he says that the discovery, this is also the discovery of Buddha nature. In other words, the bad news turns out to be good news. Everyone completely befuddled by that?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
You're not going to say anything more?
What would you like me to say?
Well, that seems like a big point, doesn't it?
Well, I don't remember, I mean, I read this section, I don't remember, I remember being very befuddled by that sentence. I don't remember if clarity arose anywhere in the remaining 12 paragraphs.
Okay. So I guess we can't get away with reading the paragraphs. So I'm going to try to present just my overall take on it. And the first point is exactly what he said, that we have, the only place we can start is a thorough examination of samsara, not giving in to any form of ignorance, that is to say, not saying, well, it's sort of okay. It's not sort of okay because anything we set up will fall apart, including our plans, our finances, our relations, but in particular also our body and our mind and our health. So there is no possibility of getting out of life alive.
What?
Can
get out of life alive.
Oh, no.
You didn't know that, at least?
That's a Hank Williams song.
Good job.
Yeah. It's a Hank Williams song.
So. Oh, it is?
Yeah, no matter how much you struggle and strive, you're never going to get out of this world alive.
Oh.
That's very good. Okay.
That should be our theme song.
Buddha Hank.
Okay, and we aren't going to give up. It seems like, especially the people who bother to come here for some reason, that we're not going to say, oh, well, I can't solve this problem. I'm just going to forget about it and go ignore it like it doesn't exist. It seems to stick around and it's very hard to ignore it. It's like Does anyone remember a Woody Allen movie in which you see Woody Allen as a little kid and he's seeing a shrink, and the shrink wants to know what's bothering him, and he said, well, the world is going to decay eventually. And the shrink distressed said, well, that's going to be a long time off, let's not bother with that. But this little kid is somehow or other disturbed by this and won't let it go. So that's a pretty good point. I'm not trying to say that Woody Allen's great in all ways, but we run away and we diminish our intelligence and our ability to live our life, actually, if we just say, well, I'm going to ignore the fact that it's going to run down, but I can't get out of it alive. So we're encouraged to keep working, even if we have no idea how we're going to do it. And that seems to be the first point, which I've called thorough examination of samsara, not giving in to ignorance. And the second point would be finding the energy to go beyond personal self, somehow having the confidence that there is nothing else that we can do except to go beyond the personal self, and making whatever effort we can to resolve this, no matter how unsatisfactory that, no matter how much we fail, no matter how much our view of self gets in the way, not to give up, to keep working on the problem. So there is a journey, and the fruition of the journey seems to be humor, courage, and equanimity. And it really is a path developing over time. We actually can become Buddhas. And we can have a life of no regrets and a death of no regrets. And sometimes we see someone who seems to inspire this in us. So I'm going to tell you about someone. A few of us know him. Most of you do not know him. And that is Binny Clark. How many people know who he is even?
Yes.
Okay, you do. Okay. Emily and I went to visit him yesterday afternoon. Binny has been in a wheelchair. He's about my age, I would say. He's been in a wheelchair since the age of 18 because of an auto accident which paralyzed him from the spine down. And he's also been a student of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche since not too long after that. And he has been known as a teacher, and he has always gotten around with a special van that he drove, and very powerful arms, and the ability to seem to do anything in his wheelchair. A very strong person, a very strong meditator. And eventually, his body wore out, and about 2 months ago, he was taken to the hospital. He could no longer use his arms. He could no longer really move seriously. And because he could not move, he then had bed sores. And bed sores were extremely threatening because they get infected and they require operations. And he could not tolerate the operations. And he then had a series of strokes, and they did some kind of operation. I'm not sure why it didn't kill him right away, but somehow it did. And they brought him home to his house. And when we visited him, he was in bed. He really could not move. It was necessary to sit him up to drink water, but he didn't like to. It was painful for him to sit up. It was also painful for him to lie down. And when he couldn't sleep because of the pain, he meditated all night because of the pain. And then he rested somewhat during the day. And he needed to rest. And it just seems like his body has very little left in it. So Emily and I went up to visit him, and two other people we know, Suzanne and Ed, were there in the room, both long-term Buddhist practitioners who live in Nashua. Then he was in the room. He was lying pretty much down. His speech was slurred because of strokes, but he was fully conscious. He had been going in and out, but he was completely conscious. He certainly knew us. It took a rather painful effort to speak at all, but he did speak, and we had to listen very carefully to hear what he was saying. But through all of this, then he had a complete sense of humor about it. He really exhibited as much or more equanimity than just about anyone I could have met. And we only stayed there about 20 minutes. We didn't get involved in a lot of different talk, but he wanted to say a few things. He wanted to know what a certain picture up on the wall was, and he actually asked about it. And he wanted to recall the piece of music he had given us. We recalled something that happened during the early days. And he just said, yeah, those were great days, and smiled. So I think this is a beautiful example of living and probably dying in a, with humor, with equanimity. And basically living without complaint. Vinny never had a complaint. I've never heard a complaint about anything. When I tried to do Tom Lin for him because of his physical disabilities, I saw that any equanimity I could offer it was pretty small compared to his own. So to me, this is fruition of Buddha nature. So it has to be non-conceptual, in the same way that simply playing a musical instrument is not conceptual. You could study it, but basically the only way to actually do it is to do it. And the only way to experience the fruition of Buddha nature, there's something which is there all along, is to let it be there. To outlast all our attempts to improve it. So, I was asked, can I say anything about Buddha nature? Somehow, there has to be, it helps to have examples. It helps to see people who have actually attained a point where they live and die the same way without regret, without complaint. To see that we can't run away, and it's not possible to continue with the complaints or any idea that what's happening is something we're not going to accept. Because there's no possibility of not accepting it. There's nothing to do except to have the confidence that we can do it, because nothing else makes sense. Ultimately, I don't think I can say much more than that. We can go back to some of those issues in some of those paragraphs if you want. So I find it hard to take Trungpa's words here and explain them. So he's saying that discovering pain and the futility of thinking we can be pain, or the idea that we can make any kind of deal. See, that seems to be basically what we're trying to do when we escape, is let's see if we can make a little deal for a little while. And it seems like facing the pain of that attempt at something that makes no sense, and facing it and giving up all hope of escape, does wear out the attempt and sets up the condition to take some kind of a leap, not of blind faith, but of nothing else makes sense. Nothing. There is no alternative. There is no choice but to go forward. And there's no sensible possibility of not going forward. And there's actually confidence in that. Trungpa says there's warmth in that, that there's intelligence in no escape, both intelligence and warmth. The no escape is painful, but there's warmth in that painfulness. It makes us no different than anyone else. It sets up no special conditions, and that itself is warmth. And that itself is availability to others.
What do you mean, no special conditions?
No bargain that we can make.
No bargain?
No, nothing we can do to get out of it for ourselves. So we're in it in the same way. There's no difference between us and the world, no difference between us and anyone else, between me and anyone else. And I think we go in and out of that. And I think we're all in it some of the time. And that's how we go forward.
There's a second paragraph that says, the bad news in itself is good news, so back to that.
Yeah.
Then he says, that potential for discovering pain is fundamentally intelligent and basically warm. Those are the two components of that instinct.
When we look at how a Buddha behaves, a Buddha has perfect equanimity of never being thrown by anything, whether it's what comes from inside or from outside. A Buddha also has intelligence which is working. A Buddha is not blanking out his mind. When we talk about not going beyond conceptual mind, it doesn't mean throwing away our intelligence. A Buddha is intelligent and sees everything happening in the world. And a Buddha not only sees everything happening in the world, but then instead of trying to seduce the things that are personally desirable, the Buddha sees what everyone needs for their own good, not what they want, but what they need. The Buddha is able to see what's necessary to for other people. And then a Buddha also doesn't have any favorites. It's like a sun that shines on everyone. And finally, the Buddha knows how to act without a plan. The Buddha's actions are well-timed because they're not trying to achieve self goals. Their actions happen when actions are appropriate. So a Buddha can be very effective in the world. And those of us who have seen realized teachers have seen this. And when you watch someone who is developing, you see that more and more. Yeah.
Does equanimity affect the strength of your feelings?
The strength of?
Of the feelings.
Feelings?
Mm-hmm.
Equanimity is that whatever happens, happens, whether you get socked with something painful or something really wonderful happens, it doesn't deflect you from just going forward. It's the power, it's tremendous staying power.
But is it, do you sense it as painful as someone else or as...
Yeah, I think that, I think that there's no escape from the pain or the pleasure. There's no shield from the world's intensity. Instead of trying to make what we usually do is to create a shield of, and that is what conceptual mind is, to dull the world down because it's too intensely painful and pleasurable. And this is nothing between oneself and the world. And not being deterred by whatever it is, just moving through whatever happens.
So you're saying that you have the same intensity of feeling, or maybe even more intensity of
more intensity.
Because you're not blocking anything off. But the equanimity aspect is then you're accepting what comes, as opposed to, you know, bargaining. I'll take this, but I won't take that. So the intensity is even more. Well, they say, isn't it, a Buddha feels an eyelash.
There's the three distinctions.
Yes, how are they?
Eyelash on the top of the hand, and then the eyelash.
It's like an eyelash.
Then are there three? The other is much more like an eyelash that's actually in your eye.
You get a little eyelash in your eye, tiny little eyelash, that you know, it really feels like a lot. That the Buddha actually feels more because the sensitivity is more. And feels more suffering for the world because the heart of compassion is so open that the suffering then is much more available in a very direct way. So there's not so much running away from it, but the fullness of the experience is acknowledged and is there.
Is it you feel it and you don't get into all the different stories about mm-hmm. it, and then it's there when it's
you
there?
You recognize the futility of the stories.
Uh-huh.
I think that, and also of the habits and tendencies that we all do to deflect or numb ourselves, as Michael said, from the reality of what's happening. You know, I'll just, watch 10 hours of TV or whatever it is that's our little thingy. We as practitioners have begun to see through ourselves, and we know that there's no place to... We know that we're doing that, we're hiding out, but we know it's not effective.
It's just interesting. Yesterday, within about a 3 hour span, I got a very good piece of news and a very bad piece of news. And I just sort of, and the good news sort of threw me a little bit, and I had these feelings that felt like sadness, and I couldn't even identify. And I started, and I, over the course of the evening, and like when I woke up at 4:30, before I intended to, I was like, all these stories about it mm-hmm. that were sort of building it, and I kind of was like, oh, what if I just felt it, like, oh, the 10,000 stories. But I think that's just such a sort of traditional thing to do, you know, sort of like a habitual thing.
Well, as it says in this chapter, ego's job is to recreate ego. So it's going to we're going to be constantly trying to reassert a sense of solidity and stability, where we're not going to feel groundless or frightened, or the truth of that we are groundless. But so what Michael, it's interesting for me, what Michael was talking about was that equanimity in our mind's eye. I mean, it was interesting hearing you talk, because in my mind's eye, you know, it's sort of like there's the ideal Buddha who's got that all together, and then there's me, and you know, when I watch myself go like a ping pong ball, right? But slowly over time you begin, you know, reacting. But slowly over time you actually begin to know yourself, and you know your own, where you're trying to hide out, and you know it's futile. You actually begin to recognize the futility of that. And that's when equanimity starts to creep, the slightest bit of equanimity starts to creep in.
When we understand that we can't make bargains with reality. We think we're trying to all the time. It's not that it's a bad idea, it's that it can't be done.
Exactly.
And when we really understand that it can't be done, then something starts to change and some melting becomes possible.
Gary?
You know, just thinking that, you know, you know, just being aware of the equanimity, but also to know it in yourself, or to have an idea of what it is myself, but also to see it in other people. You know, when walking around the world and just seeing the suffering, and nobody has to say anything. You know, I can just sense it just by looking at somebody's face, you know, of the suffering that goes on. And it's amazing. It's like, even like this morning, I remember I get up very early, and this guy that works at Dunkin' Donuts right next to where my office is, and we always kind of say hello in the morning and stuff like that. So, you know, this morning I talked to him because we didn't happen to see each other in the morning, but later on in the morning I saw him. And, you know, I just said hello to him and shook his hand and stuff, and I just remember, it was like a spark that happened, just by making that connection, by saying, you know, hi, my name's Gary, what's yours? You know, Jamal, nice to meet you. It's like making that connection. And I think that's, I don't know, maybe we're going a little bit too far with this, but it seems like, you know, being aware and then knowing that there is something you can do, possibly, you know, that can kind of shift things.
Your heart,
right?
Your heart opened up, and you acted based on that compassion.
Right, exactly.
I think that's what starts happening, is you start looking around and seeing. I mean, this is the nature of the Mahayana path. It's no longer about me and my crazy thing, help me. There's actually some opening that happens where you actually see and connect to what's going on around you,
right,
which naturally opens your heart.
Yeah. Right. It's like kind of taking the blinders off, you know, seeing the world, you know, like this, and then you take them off and you have peripheral vision to be able to see what is around you, what's around me.
And we're shielded from so much, especially death in our culture.
Yeah.
When people are older, they're shunted off to these places where they live together, and then they're gone, you know. We don't see a lot of death. We don't see, it's not really part of our everyday reality.
Mm.
And I think that's what hit me so much about being in India. It's just right in your face. The suffering is huge, and it's all around you everywhere you go. So it's actually interesting. We're more shielded, I think. We have to be sensitive, and then, I mean, it's everywhere. So it's not that it's not here. It's there. I mean, we see, you know, people in need everywhere. But,
If I could ask, try to translate it into my own language, and it seems to me one way I could understand what you're saying is you still have some objectives. You still, whatever forward means, at one given time you think this is forward, constructive, sharing whatever virtues you want to say. But then you have to accept the consequences. You know, and that's the equanimity is. You know, you try to figure out what's a forward move, whatever that means. And then whatever happens, that's the new piece of information. You accept it, even though it may not be what you had in mind. And then that's part of the feedback, so to speak, and now you make a new, fresh start. You know, by accepting what actually happened. So that's the openness. It's you can't make demands, but you have to accept the
Well, you don't have a choice, do you? You actually it's actually choices. You actually have to begin right there.
Yeah, that's a new...
That's it. And that's what Michael's saying. It isn't... I mean, we'd all make other choices if we could. But you have to begin with what's right there in front of you.
Yeah, but the choice is to accept. The choice is...
What else are you going to do?
Well, you still have to formulate something. I mean, the ego is... the self is, trying to provide whatever service you want to give to it. And it says, okay, take a step in that direction. Yes, that's your best combination of understanding. And then whatever happens, you'll say, okay, I accept it with equanimity. And as best I can see, I'm not attached to this next move. And then, you make a purposeful move, and then, you accept the results, and you accept the consequences because you chose to do that, but you didn't choose the result, like your friend Bernie. Yeah, he probably didn't choose this path,
But it has come his way, and he's willing now to accept it. And as it goes, some others may want to end it there or not. But and it also, I mean, that includes the notion of, you know, going into meditation and trying not to be conceptual. That's sort of a step forward, if you consider that forward, and then whatever happens, that's feedback. And then you start fresh off again. So the equanimity, to me, seems to be a combination of a few things.
Well, is that your theory at the moment?
Hmm?
Are you giving me your theory at the moment?
It looks like it, yeah. Now, Do
you want to hear my theory?
Yeah, after one more thing. And now I forgot that.
Oh, no.
No, yes, I would like to hear.
Why would you want to hear my theory? It's just my theory. It's a conceptualization. It can't be good in nature. Why would you want to hear
it? Well, I don't know. You're stating assumptions. I'm open to whatever is in front of me.
Well, do you want to hear my theory about the taste of garlic?
The nutrition of garlic.
No. What it takes.
Just to answer the thing if you want. What's your point?
The point is that there's no point to my giving you a theory of garlic or my giving you a theory of Buddha nature, but you probably know the experience of the taste of garlic, so you don't need to ask anyone.
Well, let me say, it seems to me I'm asking you to rephrase the statement, there's no point to anything.
I didn't say that.
No, right, to one thing, there's no point to doing what?
I said there's no point to something?
No, you're emphasizing there's no point to doing one way or the other. There's no point about talking about garlic, or there's no point about talking about...
What I'm trying to point out is that there's no particular benefit to expressing our opinion about Buddha nature. We have lots of thoughts about Buddha nature, right? But saying, is this it, and telling someone it's guaranteed not to be it. Mm. So there's no point in approaching it that way. Still, we keep having ideas, right? We haven't dropped Buddha nature, we haven't stopped talking about it. So, we're all trying to grasp it, right? And if we grasp it and say, is this it? It's not it.
In the reading on chapter 2, mm-hmm. he says in the first part of the discussion, I actually laughed at myself on that reading because I... Who is Taranatha? Taranatha says about the Buddha.
Great teacher.
I read, everybody carries in his heart. This, first of all, is too much male stuff.
Well, we know that.
1973, yeah, but
isn't it hopeful that it changed somewhat?
Yeah. So, anyway, so everybody carries in her heart a perfectly produced image of the Buddha, perfectly, beautifully made, cast in gold. Everybody has such an image in her heart. That seems to be true. And I read that and I thought, oh my gosh, that's so wonderful. I have a little golden Buddha in my heart. That is so neat. And then I thought that was, okay, wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
The next thing coming down is in the discussion. So take, for example, sitting down to read a book on Buddhism. We come to the book through confusion. And he's asking him, you're saying that's Buddha nature? And he said, yeah, whether you understand it or not, the very attempt to find clarity is Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. And then he said, well, what about ego? And he said, well, ego's approach is the mentality of the lucrative, the profitable. I should be getting something out of this book, otherwise my effort is wasted. Unrealistic sort of business-like mentality.
if things don't make sense, your search is wasted. So as soon as, it's what you're saying, as soon as you start, oh, I have that little golden Buddha in my heart, right. It's so wonderful, then you're trying to tell me that, oh, that's not Buddha nature. It's really funny to read that.
If you read a poem, there's multiple images, and which image is it that the poem is about? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's sort of the way, I found the main text a little opaque, but the discussion was made more sense to me, because I think the sort of question and answer and circle, having the, you know, the interaction between the teacher and the students made it easier to understand what the shape of it mm-hmm. was.
He said a lot of good things there. Mm-hmm. Like, all the attempts to get something are manifestations of Buddha nature. Again and again, when ego's trying to do something, ego has no gasoline of its own. It's Buddha nature that's doing it. That doesn't mean that the experience of the person understands that at the time, but if, and he pointed to that, well, your ancestors worked to make a wealthy country. That's ultimately an expression of Buddha nature, whether it's realized as such or not. So, Taranatha, I don't know when he lived. Is that anything?
No, I don't.
Okay, so I can't answer that. But he said something which a lot of Tibetans evidently thought was controversial. But basically, the terminology is Buddha nature is unborn, unobstructed, and
unoriginated.
Unoriginated, okay.
But he also did say solid and permanent.
Yeah.
Which is really like same
right.
word.
Right.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, so in other words, it's been flipped around because Buddha nature is unborn. Therefore, how's he using the word birth here? There's a metaphor going on.
There's not a start.
Yeah,
have a present.
There's no parents.
Oh, there's no
parents. Yeah, there's no start, there's no parents. There's nothing gave birth to it. There's no effort in it.
Just always was.
It always is, was.
Yes.
If you, other than you can't characterize it. So in that sense, it's unoriginated, and what does he say? It's something solid.
Unobstructed.
That's the next one, okay. Unobstructed, here refers to freedom from karma.
Mm-hmm.
So, our Buddha nature is unobstructed, it's free from karma. So if our karma was that we were, if my karma was that I was born to very wealthy parents and they gave me everything I could possibly have and then they gave me the ability to go study and meditate and to be great teachers, and we call that good karma, right? Or maybe I was born of a mother with alcohol syndrome or something like that, and there was no father around, and I was cast out onto the street to starve and somehow didn't die. So we call that bad karma, right? And Buddha nature is present whether there is good karma or bad karma, so it's free of karma in that sense. And we have instances of teachers we can look upon. For instance, the Gautama, the Buddha, was born into a royal family. He had everything he could possibly want. He was given tremendous luxury. Every need he had was met instantly. And Milarepa, whose story some of you may know, I don't know, was born into utter poverty, into extreme injustice, and brought up to hate his aunt and uncle who had stolen his mother's property. And that's the story that was drilled into him as he grew up. So he grew up with horrible karma. And both are, from our lineage point of view, regarded as great realized teachers. So that's what unobstructed means. It's Buddha nature does not depend upon karma. And that's the third one.
Unborn, unoriginated, and unobstructed.
Well, he did unobstruct.
Uncaused. It's not caused,
and
effect. Is that calm?
You got the two of those, the last two years.
Non-dwelling.
Okay. So what is non-dwelling? It's that it doesn't depend on what our mind and our thoughts do. But the nature is behind. Well, in particular, if we have wonderful, clear thoughts, that they are the nature of Buddha. If we have horrible, mean, terrible thoughts, its nature is Buddha. It's only Buddha nature, a manifestation of Buddha nature. So non-dwelling is beyond good and bad, beyond any judgment that what's going on is good or what's going on is bad.
So why do you use forward and backwards then?
What?
Why do you use we choose to go forward? If there's no direction, if the word direction is not applicable to Buddha nature, then why use that word that is directional?
Oh, in the sense of having a path?
I don't know. You use it. You say, how do you choose to go forward? You make a choice to go forward. Does that mean
So first we're giving characteristics of Buddha nature.
Yeah.
Okay. And characteristics of Buddha nature, we have to remember, are again not a concept about it. They're more saying here is non-concept. And, sorry, I'm going a little bit roundabout. But path is what do we do? And if we don't run away, if we don't diminish our intelligence by ignoring our nature, if we keep coming around, and we can't come to any formulation of Buddha nature, certainly, we do see that that everything we do is ego, right? We look at every thought that comes up, and every thought that comes up we can see comes up because of something we hope for or something we fear of. And we even gave you a catalog of those because they cover just about everything. We hope for pleasure, we fear pain, we hope for fame, we don't want to be ignored. We hope for praise, we don't want blame, and so on. We hope for gain, whether it's economic gain or gain of something or other. And we shift through all of these all the time. So we start to see that our thoughts are made up of nothing but this is all about me and my hopes and fear. So we start to wear out the idea that we can keep doing this. We're wearing out the idea that there's any possibility of bargaining or getting away with something or making a temporary peace that's of any value. And this is path. This is what we have to keep working on. So that's not a description of Buddha nature. That's to help us move to realizing it. So,
can I ask one more question about Buddha nature?
As long as you don't ask, is this it?
Is this
as long as you're not going to give me your opinion about Buddha nature, because I'm not going to give you mine.
Okay, I'm going to give you my opinion of an analogy. The analogy is sort of like the sun being obscured by the clouds.
Ah, those are nice analogies.
Okay, but it seems to me in one part of the book it says that it's not obscured or she's not obscured, whatever, and yet it says it is obscured, like, kind of. So I can interpret it as somehow we're fabricating something inside our heads. But the analogy I'm concerned that makes, you know, a little bit of acceptance in my mind is an analogy with a lightning bolt. I'm sure you know that the lightning is the after effects of the transfer of electrons between your
Do we need quantum physics?
Well, that's what I'm going to that's junior high school.
Is there a point to coming up with a scientific theory?
Yeah. It's my analogy to Buddha nature.
Okay.
So, may I say it? The analogy is this.
What are you going to do with your analogy?
Compare it to Buddha nature? What else do you do with an analogy?
All right, go ahead. Give us
your analogy. Just let me finish it because he's trying to, you know, cut through it. You know? Okay, the thing is, we see the results of the actual physical phenomenon that the transfer of electrons. And I'm saying, well, maybe that's what Buddha nature is. We never really directly experienced Buddha nature in the immediate time. We see the effects. For example, I would like her opinion next, is that, we sense some sort of constructive, beneficial, social result, feeling, concept inside us. And we say, well, that's Buddha nature. Well, that's the result of Buddha nature. We don't directly experience the immaterial or the non-quantifiable Buddha nature, because that would be a contradiction to say we directly, you know, experience it in a consciousness.
I'm going to stop you there.
Yeah, I think that's my point.
I should say, we can experience Buddha nature. It is in the gap. And the gap is what? It's what? So it's what? That's what Buddha nature is. It's the space. It's that open space. And it's more of a question than it is an answer. You're never going to find a definition. You're never going to find something that you can convey to someone else. It's a personal experience. And it's the opening, you could say. This is the heart opening that we actually can contact our something that's inside of ourselves, that there's an open-hearted quality that arises. But it's nothing you could really describe or have a solid concept about, because whatever you try to grasp onto, it's just grasping onto something. And there's nothing there to grasp onto.
So I think that's what he's saying.
No, he's not.
No, that's not what he's saying.
No, he's saying he has a theory about it.
He has a theory.
No. That space, there's something that you can't really see or touch or feel. But there are manifestations, maybe, as you're trying to say.
That's what he said, but that's not the case.
But is compassion a manifestation of Buddha nature, I guess, would be my question.
Yeah, but he's saying that we can't experience Buddha nature.
Yeah,
and
he said
we
can't experience.
Okay.
Are they manifestations of it? I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay.
No, Buddha nature is to be.
That gap, yeah.
It's the gap.
Buddha nature is to be experienced, okay? So metaphors are given, okay? They are not scientific theories. And they are metaphors. They are not an explanation of Buddha nature.
Right.
So if we take the the analogy of the sun, and the obscurations are clouds, and if the clouds go away, then we realize the sun. Now, that is not an explanation of Buddha nature. It's an analogy. An analogy has to be dropped because it doesn't work if you hold on to it. If you take that analogy, it's got big problems. For instance, the sun is not permanent. It's going to burn out in several billion years, as Woody Allen pointed out. Furthermore, if you start to take that as a real explanation, then the next thing you're going to say is, well, but there are lots of other suns in other galaxies. And so the analogy may kick your mind in the right direction, okay? But you have to give it up, because if you take it literally, it doesn't work. Or the one about the lamp. To Tibet is this idea of a lamp that's enclosed in a vase, and the vase can be broken, and then the lamp's exposed. So to an 18th century Tibetan, that lamp would be a butter lamp. But a butter lamp doesn't really work. It'll burn out. There's only so much butter in it. And if you used that analogy, you probably wouldn't use a butter lamp. You'd use an LED, right? and then you'd be having to deal with theories of will the electric companies stop delivering power, or will the batteries wear out? So there's another one which isn't given here, but which I added, which is, it's one of the 10 analogies from the Uttara Tantra Shastra. And this one says, so the analogy is of a very poor person living in a hut, and beneath the dirt floor of the hut is a buried treasure.
Yeah,
but this person is ignorant of the treasure. He doesn't know that he could go get it. So again, it's an analogy, because if we found a huge treasure full of diamonds and pearls and gold, we'd wear it out eventually. We'd spend it, or someone would spend it. So it doesn't, it's not an explanation. But an analogy might kick our minds. If we take the analogy and drop it, it could kick our minds in some direction, okay? So that's the use of imagery. Not that it's a logical explanation, but that it might be useful as long as we don't think it's an explanation. Do you see the point?
Yeah, that's why I use the word analogy.
Yeah, but you want it to be a theory that actually explained it. And furthermore, you said,
well, you inferred that I didn't imply it.
Well, but you did say.
I was just trying to say it, I was leaning. I was getting help about trying to deal with this, you know, subtlety of equanimity by Buddha nature. By thinking that way. So I think what Emily said was fantastic.
Yes, because you were saying you can't experience Buddha nature. Okay, that's
yeah, directly, and you can't.
We can, but the whole point is we can't.
Yeah, I know, that's what she was saying.
Okay.
But you can't explain it.
Yeah, but.
So.
You can't explain it, but we experience it. That's why we're trying to drop theories. And my analogies are only analogies.
It's experiential.
There are a number of other things that are in these questions. There are some great things here about if you really believe you've experienced Buddha nature, is that dangerous? And he says, yes, it's dangerous if you use that to have power over yourself or power over others. Mm-hmm. And the world is full of charlatans who do that.
He was very adamant about that.
Yes, mm-hmm. Very.
Funk in particular. Mm-hmm.
Someone also asked him, what about a traditional society in which nothing changes?
Mm. And
he said, no, that's impossible. It changes, meaning if the people inside it don't change it, something's going to come in from the outside and change it. There's no such thing as getting into that kind of rut. The world doesn't allow that kind of rut. It'll destroy it, which is interesting. So we've run out of time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Does anyone wish to say the last word?
I do. I will say, next week we're going to the next chapter, chapter 3, and it's called The Spiritual Friend, and also it treats the subject of Maitri, friendliness to oneself as a starting point, and I'll be leading that discussion. So read chapter 3, The Spiritual Friend.
Can I ask a favor, and it's a favor, you don't have to do it,
yeah.
But I find the reading really like hard, and part of it is I read it late in the day, I'm a little tired.
Yeah, the text.
If we had a little outline ahead of time, like here are the main points he's driving at, then I wouldn't be wandering through and trying to figure out where am I supposed to pull stuff out, because I find myself reading it and going, well, that's a lot of words, but I'm not sure where the words are heading me, and I'll get stuck on one idea and perseverate there and think, is that the point? Because I struggle with it a lot.
I tried making that line and you saw it. It wasn't as useful as breaking out of it.
Well, but even it doesn't have to be an outline. It can be like, here are the main points as I see it. And then as I read, I'd be, oh, okay, I see where that point.
So you're saying it would help to have it ahead of time rather than just...
Yeah, like a paragraph. Yeah, like a paragraph online. Uh-huh. Like, here's what I think this...
Yeah, I can do that.
And sometimes part of the problem is that these are transcripts, right?
Right.
It's transcripts of a talk and a question and answer session, but we're reading it in print as if it was a formal essay.
Right.
No. So I'm trying to read it a little more loosely on the assumption that there's a little bit of back and forth.
Right.
And, you know, that it's not, it wasn't intended really to be written form, even though that's how we're, you know, taking it in.
That's great.
And everything you said is double-edged. That's what's so hard.
It's edited too. So is the way I type this readable, or is it better to have more space between the paragraphs? Is that part of the?
It's not the typing. It's the word.
You're okay.
It's the word.
I don't care about that.
It's the word.
Okay. Are you getting something out of it though?
Yes.
Okay.
Good.
All right.
It might be interesting to start with people sharing the salient points at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So that we could see what it is, and maybe you could say, well, wait, but we could figure out
right.
sharing
more
the key points that we all find.
Okay. So I will, on the next chapter, I'll put something up online under chapter, what are we on?
Three.
Chapter 3. So, you know, you can look for that, and so maybe that will help you as a study guide.